I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with George Shialaba, book critic, essayist, and contributing editor at The Baffler. And to learn more and really find an archive of years of George's writings, you can go to georgeshialaba.net, and I'm going to spell that for you. George is just as you think it is, and it's one word, George Shialaba. The last name is S-C-I-A-L-A-B-B-A, S-C-I-A-L-A-B-B-A, georgeshialaba.net. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview about every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, and Robert Wright on Why He's a Buddhist, just a few. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere, and possibly forever on Apple Podcasts, Podomatic.com, and at my site, TerrenceMcNally.net. That's TerrenceMcNally.net. Now, a quick plug for participation, which I've been doing every show. Here's five organizations that you can plug into and learn from. And really, I was thinking about it this morning, there are many more, but just start with these five if you want to get involved or more involved in what we're doing now during the Trump administration and really building for a future after it. The most prominent organization, I'd say, is Indivisible.us. Indivisible.us, they get like 5,000 chapters locally, and they put out a thing every week saying, here's the actions you might need to take this week. MoveOn.org, MoveOn, one word, .org, been around for years, was primarily digital, but is coordinating much more with the grassroots over the last couple of years. In the state of California, a similar organization, Courage Campaign, Courage Campaign, one word, .org, again, was primarily digital, now working hand in hand with grassroots. And two very specific ones, 5calls.org, that's the number 5 and the word calls as one word, 5calls, and that will tell you the calls that you might make if you want to be relevant and timely to your representatives. And then finally, townhallproject.com, Town Hall Project, one word, and that tells you when your representatives are going to be holding town halls near you where you can go and actually speak to and with your representatives. Now to today's guest. George Shialaba is a bit of a throwback. He held down a day job for 35 years while publishing over 400 book reviews and essays. And when I asked him if he could do an interview, he wrote back, "The problem is I'm not really an expert on anything. Do you know that famous Greek saying, the fox knows many things, the hedgehog knows one big thing, I'm definitely a fox?" And in my reply, I told him, that addition to our being classmates, we both graduated Harvard in 1969 and we'll bump into each other this May at our 50th reunion, this may be the biggest thing we have in common. I also am a generalist. It's why I do interviews rather than write my own books. And even my interviews aren't even focused beyond what I broadly refer to as a world that just might work. George and I didn't know each other at school, but I've been following his writing from afar, and when I read a provocative book review in a recent New Yorker, I wrote to congratulate him, and you will hear now probably the longest conversation we've ever had with each other. George has published 4 essay collections, What Are Intellectuals Good For?, The Modern Predicament, For the Republic, and Low Dishonest Decades. His writing is archived, as I said, at georgeshialaba.net. Where you'll also find, and this is what he has on the front page of his website. His email address is right there, and he invites you to write him about anything you read there that interests you. And also, let me tell folks, we're recording this conversation Tuesday, March 26th. Welcome, George Shialaba, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Thank you, Terry. Nice to make your acquaintance a little more deeply after 50 years.
Exactly. And for those who noticed the use of the word Terry, that was me in college and still is with most of my classmates. George, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. And so can you tell us about your path to what you're doing these days? And feel free to go way back, mention mentors, turning points, moments of decision, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, my first identity was as an altar boy. I was very devout as a child, and thinking about it since, I think it was in some measure a response to the environment I grew up in, which was an inner city, second and third generation Italian immigrant neighborhood. And it was not very stimulating. None of the adults I knew, my family, anyone else's family, were educated or read much of anything, except the tabloids. The kids I knew and hung out with were interested in sports, girls, and, well, I'm sure that there was some individuality to my interest in religion, but I think it was in large part just a religious life seemed more interesting to me than growing up and getting the same kind of job that most of their parents were working at. I glommed onto the church.
I Irish Catholic background also was quite committed to my altar boy role for a few years. I know that feeling. It's looked like that's where sort of the power, the glamour, and the mystery was.
Mm-hmm. Well, your listeners may not actually have seen you or seen a picture of you in the flesh, but of course I haven't seen you for 50 years, but thinking of you in the late 60s, I can very much see you in an altar boy surplus and black and white vestments.
Yep.
I'm sure you were cherubic. So I investigated the Franciscan order, which was the order of the nuns who taught me and the priests who taught me in high school. But they were very unbookish. They're the least sort of intellectual of the Catholic religious orders. And so I hesitated, and while I was hesitating, I was recruited by Opus Dei, which is a new and dynamic traditionalist Catholic group, and the new idea is that you live in the world, you have a secular profession, but you're just as rigorous in your spirituality as the religious orders. That sounded good, and I became a member. I was a member of Opus Dei all 4 years in college, and left soon afterward because I majored in intellectual history. There was a clash, and I gave up the faith. It was terribly, it was traumatic. I guess I just didn't have much of any other framework for life and feeling. And so it took me many years of wandering literally and figuratively around the Cambridge counterculture to find my feet. And when I did, it was the middle of the academic job crisis, and going back to graduate school seemed like a very impractical thing to do. So I sort of lucked into a job through a friend, which at Harvard, which had good benefits and was fairly secure, and left me a lot of time to read and write eventually.
If you would, just to, you know, fill out the picture for people, what was that job?
I was living in Cambridge all this time, and the job was at Harvard. I was a building manager at one of the research centers scheduled all of the seminars and classes in the meeting rooms, and also got people's offices painted and
carpeted. And this is the job that I mentioned in the intro that you held for 35 years.
Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Let me just comment another thing that seems to, at the point at which I graduated, I also couldn't, it was right at that point that I couldn't see going to graduate school. For me, I think it was, what made my decision was I thought, well, why do I want to put myself, this is 1969 for people, why do I want to put myself in just another big establishment institution? There must be another way. And so, like you, I a lot of our friends found that path, took that path, but neither of us did. So you land this day job, and you say it gives you a lot of time. Were you actually able to read and write on Harvard's dime?
Yes. Yes. I mean, it wasn't a complete sinecure. I did have to get those rooms painted and those rooms scheduled. And I also actually spent a lot of time just schmoozing with faculty, graduate students, even undergraduates. But yes, I did get some, and that was tolerated as a kind of contribution to the morale of the building.
I understand.
But in the quietest moments, I did get to read and even write some, yes.
Mm-hmm. And let me go back a little bit to this Opus Dei. I never came in contact with them, although I knew of their existence. What was those 4 years you're in college, you're, as you say, studying intellectual history, and yet as you've gone into this thinking, I want a good education and I'm going to be a fine Opus Dei, right? This is going to be my life. What a little bit about the process of moving away from that?
Mm-hmm. Well, first of all, the fact that you didn't hear about it in your undergraduate years was my fault. I was supposed to be
recruiting,
proselytizing all my Catholic classmates, and I guess I let you slip through the net. But anyway, it involved a lot of a lot of prayer, meditation, spiritual exercises, a lot of outreach, which we called apostolate, frequent retreats. It also, and rather faithfully for me, involved studying Catholic scholastic philosophy in depth, which I found just very unconvincing, Thomistic metaphysics and epistemology and so on. And it just became gradually clearer, a fairly disembodied intellectual process, actually, that what I was supposed to believe, what these courses were teaching me, I couldn't believe.
Mm-hmm.
And that brought me to the point, looking at the modern European history I was studying and asking, what is the church's role, effect, position been? And I found that it had been to hold back freedom of thought,
mm-hmm.
and in large part political freedom too.
Mm-hmm.
It had fought what seemed to me to be the noblest, the bravest, the most beneficent movements and forces in modern history. So that's what really clinched it.
Sure, sure.
Staying seemed to me equivalent to aligning myself with the Inquisition.
Yeah.
And the Syllabus of Errors and all of the other.
Right, right. Yeah, I interviewed Elaine Pagels recently. on her book, Why Religion, and she points out that the word heresy translates as choice. You see where I'm going with that, that basically there was no choice, and if you thought there was choice, that was heresy.
Yes, exactly.
So let me ask you one thing. Do you have, for me, I feel so distant from it, though members of my family still attend church every Sunday, not all but some, to the crisis that the Catholic Church faces today. Any thoughts about that?
Well, it looks just like a bureaucratic cock-up to me. I don't see a profound spiritual element to it. I mean, the abuse crisis particular.
Yes.
On the other hand, there is a vital current of conservative Catholic thought. At least I see it in this area. There's wealthy conservatives have begun funding on campuses study centers, and there's one particularly active one here at Harvard, and I'm on their mailing list, and so I get a sense that there are a lot of young religious people who really do find Catholicism challenging and find liberalism, both political and intellectual, kind of tired. And partly that's just the cyclical nature of things.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, it's impressive, and there's life in Catholicism yet. But at least as a form of thought and spiritual practice, but as an organization, bureaucratically, it just seems like it totally clueless.
Yeah, yeah. To my perspective, a pope that seems to be, the most liberal, the most progressive pope in my, except for John the 23rd, back in the, I guess that was the late 50s, early 60s. But the abuse scandal just seems to be turning so many people I know who, like, persisted into their adulthood as Catholics and now say, I know a few who say, I just can't go to church anymore, because of that. And so
Yes. One person I know, actually one of my editors, is used to work at First Things, which was, the magazine?
Don't.
It was a quarterly, Catholic quarterly, in the 80s, from the 80s, it still exists. Very vital and forceful. Richard John Newhouse was the founder and editor for a long time. And this friend of mine was, an editor of mine, was an editor there for many years and had political and theological differences with Newhouse, who was rather hard to get along with, and left, but remained a Catholic and has been a fairly prominent writer and columnist about moral and religious issues. But about 3 months ago, Jeff said in a column publicly, "I can't take it. I've had one body blow after another." To my allegiance to the church, and it's one too many, and so he he's left, and I assume that's true of a lot of other people.
Yeah, too. Yeah. Let me tell people, by the way, you're listening to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with George Shialaba. He's a book critic, an essayist, and a contributing editor at The Baffler. And you can learn more and find an archive of his writings at georgeshialaba.net. And that's one word, George, and then SCIALABBA.net. I read an interesting anecdote about how you initially began publishing your writing or having your writing published. Can you tell that story?
Well, one day in the late 70s, I was listening to the radio, and this voice came on that just seemed to me the incarnation of reasonableness and rationality and confidence and judiciousness. Anyway, it grabbed me, and so I listened to the end of the interview, and it turned out to be Noam Chomsky. The interview had been about politics, and I only knew Noam Chomsky as a linguist, and that was all I knew about him, didn't know anything about linguistics. So I went looking for some of his political writings, and became a fan, big fan, still am.
Yeah.
And read somewhere or other that he had a big book coming out at the end of 1979. And I was very excited. It sounded like a kind of magnum opus. And I thought to myself, well, all right, this is going to turn American political culture on its ear. It was the 79, Jimmy Carter was still president, and he, I remember, his administration was called the Human Rights Administration. And this book by Chomsky was called The Political Economy of Human Rights, two large volumes. Anyway, the book came out, and American political culture was completely and totally unaffected. There was not a word about it for 6 months anywhere in the English-speaking world. So I was flummoxed, and so I wrote a long letter to the editor, books review editor of The Village Voice. Started out, dear editor, let me tell you about this new book by Noam Chomsky. And so I wrote 3,000 words and ended it by saying, you know, I'm not a writer, and I don't expect you'll ask me to write it, review it, but, you know, please ask a real writer to review it. And he called back in a few days and said, well, I beg to differ. You may not be a writer, but we're going to publish this review. And they just took the first sentence off and the last sentence off and ran the review and then asked for some more. So that was mine.
Yeah, that's so excellent. By the way, that voice you heard is a voice that one hears often on KPFK and Pacifica. he is very familiar to many here. The New Yorker review that I mentioned was, I just want to briefly talk about this, was for a book, The Goodness Paradox, The Strange Relationship Between Virtue and Violence in Human Evolution by Richard Wrangham. And you titled your review, Did Capital Punishment Create Morality? And as I say, when I read it, it reminded me, you know, just sort of the, you know, the interesting things you wrote about and the interesting ways you approach them. Can you share just a bit about that book and your take on it?
Sure. Evolutionary theorists, Wrangham, the author, Richard Wrangham, is a primatologist, studies great apes. But evolution is, right now, evolutionary theory is an extraordinary patchwork of disciplines. There are psychologists, archaeologists, geneticists, primatologists, and many other disciplines, all of them turning up evidence of one kind or another and sort of tendering it, you know, putting it out there for these colleagues in other disciplines to make of it what they can. And a few people, Christopher Bohm is one of them, he's another primatologist. Wrangham is also, it's just a really synthetic mind. And this book puts together a really remarkable kind of range of evidence to argue that the origins of morality were in group rebellion against alpha males. That kind of the default form of organization among great apes, including proto-human beings,
mm-hmm.
was alpha males. The strongest male would, you know, beat up all the other males one at a time, and then monopolize the women. It's still the predominant form of social organization among chimpanzees. But when bonobos are cousins of chimpanzees, they live in a slightly different region of Central Africa, were discovered. Bonobos are a female-dominated society. There are no alpha males. And so in his previous book, Rangam went through all the evidence about bonobos and tried to reconstruct how that happened, why they had this remarkably cooperative and female-dominated society. The two things are connected, of course. So anyway, that prepared him to ask how it happened in human beings. And he does conclude and makes a strong case that once humans could communicate, I mean, why don't chimpanzees, for example, gang up against their alpha male tyrants? Because they can't communicate. They can't make plans together. But once humans were able to do that, they conspired to eliminate the alpha males, and the resulting form of social organization was a kind of committee of elders, men who had deposed the tyrant, and around this form of organization, rules grew up. So that's a bare bones explanation mm-hmm. Of his theory, but you know, and it may be wildly wrong. The thing is, there are just no competitors, or hardly any competitors. None of this degree of intricacy or complexity.
You mean in terms of explanations?
Yes, terms of explanations that fit with evolution and that actually draw on evidence from evolution to account for morality.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. I mean, when I read the title, I thought, oh, this is about capital punishment. But basically, it's about that, what if you kill the king, and then you got to figure out, what do we do now?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In thinking about this conversation, George, a big question occurred to me, which you and I had a conversation off air, which I didn't mention to you, but it occurred to me since we've spoken. And if you're willing to take it on with me, it's that our generation, at least a certain percentage of our generation, I think thought we were going to change the world. We were going to change America. We were going to change the system. We were going to change the incentives. We were going to change the hierarchies, all of those sorts of things. And I can remember, certainly, you know, it was a mixture of youth and events, I guess, really thinking, yeah, and it's you know, there's certain changes are going to happen. I mean, it's not going to be, you know, it's not going to be perfect. I was smart enough to, you know, to know that. But that I thought, you know, it would change in ways that wouldn't be reversed. And there would, it would be a new chapter sort of going on from there. And obviously, I'll just make one example. We now have our third boomer president. There have only there. I think, I mean, unless you know, a Biden or a Sanders or you know whatever is elected, I think these may be the only three.
Mm-hmm.
Obama was an exception, and I assume the next one will be. So what you have is in Bill Clinton, I think, just such an example of the '60s in that he was a brilliant, gifted, and waylaid by his own indulgences. if you will. You know, took his eye off the ball, and so there's one, just what I consider the great wasted opportunity. Then you have Bush, you know, just up until the current president, I would have thought certainly the least competent in our lifetime, and certainly in the top few of least competent. From, you know, again, I will mention, not elected by the popular vote, but led us to the greatest, you know, recession since the Depression and war based on lies, war which still goes on. And the third is Donald Trump. So clearly something went wrong. So my question, the big question, which we can engage with perhaps for the rest of this time, is what went right, what went wrong, and where do we go from here?
Some things went right. Clinton did come into office trying to trying to get universal health care. That was a generous impulse.
By the way, I don't mean to link it to those presidents. I just use an example of the of our failure, but sort of more that, you know, the you know, we had civil rights impulses, we had equal rights impulses, we had environmental impulses, we had peace impulses, et cetera, et cetera. These are the things I thought, you know, society was going to be remade in our image. And so when I asked the question, what went right, it's what sort of that, the if I sort of think the best of the 60s, you know, what went right coming out of that, what went wrong, and where do we go from here?
I'm not sure we do have a lot to show for it. Mostly it's just a matter of preservation. I mean, the real last triumph, the last victories in American politics were the New Deal. And, you know, the New Deal persisted through the early 70s, and it's been unraveling since. And you know, the Republicans have been unraveling it enthusiastically. Democrats have been trying to hold, you know, a finger in the dike. But there's been, you know, in that scenario, the triumphant, you know, barbarian invaders, the new right, the Republicans, massing against the New Deal, and the beleaguered defensive Democrats just kind of trying to defend what remnants of it they can. That's been the kind of large-scale dynamic of the last 40 years, 45, 50 years, rather than, as we expected, gradual but inexorable march through the institutions, reforming them, you know, one after another in the direction of equality and participation. You know, part of what happened was, I mean, in a sense, the real political, on a sort of tactical, strategic level, the real political story of the last four decades has been the amazing skillfulness of the Republican just political consultancy and propaganda machine. How, they, first of all, they brilliantly isolated the Democratic Party from the South by means of Nixon's Southern strategy. I mean, Johnson was afraid that he'd lost the South for a generation by signing the Civil Rights Bill. And Lee Atwater made sure he did.
Yep.
Then the Reagan operatives were also, again, very skillful, you know, all of Reagan's Morning in America. I paid for this mic. You know, Reagan was an amiable duffer who really had a single idea, but somehow he got sold as the incarnation of everything good and decent about America. And just, you know the book, What's the Matter with Kansas? It by Thomas Frank, it very skillfully demonstrates how the Republicans have managed to convince white working America that it has their back, when in fact it's really laughing behind their back. And it's partly a culture divide. You know, we and ours, college graduates from elite colleges with mostly comfortable jobs and lifestyles, are deeply resented. You know, part of that's, I think we might have reached middle America if we hadn't been sort of drowned out by those armies of Republican political operatives.
So you really do feel that, I mean, we've talked about many times on this show, you know, much of this grows out of the Powell memo and the realization that these values for the environment, for worker safety, et cetera, were for women's rights, civil rights, were taking on too much power. And so the business community, the right, had to assert itself. But you really place a lot of stock in that the consultancies that grew out of it, the Frank Luntzes, the namers, the idea people, the marketing people, really have had a profound effect on the way Americans look at the world and their lives.
Well, they have. We also made a mistake, though. We took the route of the courts instead of going out to state legislatures and trying to make laws there rather than by judicial decree. You know, it partly is a result of our formation. We assumed that, you know, if you get the analysis right, you get a good grade, and so if you convince the court, you change the society, but it doesn't work that way. You have to go out and change people's minds, and that's it's what the Republicans are smart enough to do, while a lot of us in the professions, or at least our generational coevals, were...
Let me jump to something which in one of your articles, and I'm forgetting the title of it, but one of your essays, which is the one in which you you reference Looking Backward, Edward Bellamy's book from 1889, I believe, which puts someone in the 23rd century looking back at life and so on. But in the essay, you talk a lot about... Well, here's one line from it. You say the most galling part of each day is encountering the ubiquitous self-designation of apologists for capitalism as champions of freedom. And you, so I think this is part and parcel of what we're talking about here, it became in some ways a redefinition of what freedom meant, so that regulation of a corporation was an infringement of freedom. And no matter, you know, ignoring the ripple effects that regulation might have on the freedom of individuals. Can you talk a bit about that whole thing of their redefinition of freedom and where you think that's gone wrong and why that argument so persists?
Well, partly it's that there's an ambiguity in the definition of freedom. Freedom is supposedly the absence of constraint. If you look deeply enough, as I actually say in the same section of that essay, there is never constraint is never absent. It's not a philosophically coherent notion. Everything is caused. So if you want to argue that people who don't have enough money to to buy health insurance, to send their kids to decent schools, etc., are less free than people who do, you have to make a somewhat subtler argument than the person who simply says, well, what do you mean? They're free. They're just as free as people who can. This one sort of one level, one layer, one dimensional definition of freedom is it's intellectually simpler. It's much easier to convey than the argument that ties freedom to capacity, to ability. And unfortunately, our political conversation it's not geared to make a subtle argument, you need everybody you need people to sit still for it.
Yeah.
You need people to be able to hear the nuances of what you're saying. And our political conversation is conducted in basically 20 seconds is what you get on a TV talk show to make a comment or an argument. Longer than that, and you're not invited back. You're thought to be prolix or not concise enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's partly the very sort of physical structuring of our conversation makes it difficult to both make and apprehend, to speak and to listen to extended and intricate arguments.
One of the points you make is that the freedom to drink clean water, right? For instance, is abridged by the freedom of the corporation to pollute, without regard. Mm-hmm. And one can just take that and see it in all different realms of life, that the freedom to have health care, to have your health be dealt with, is an abridgment on the freedom of pharmaceutical and insurance companies to make a profit from that same phenomenon and so on. And that it appears that that enough Americans buy the as you say, the easy to convey notion of freedom, that freedom is, just leave everyone.
Just the absence of constraint.
Yeah, and just don't constrain anyone and good will triumph, versus the more subtle argument that in fact, if you hold that one of America's greatest values is freedom, and I think there's no doubt about that, that the individual's freedom to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, to pursue those, is infringed by corporations. And as you point out in something else, which we've pointed out on this show many times, which is that within a corporation, the rich and wealthy have all the power. And then as that study out of Princeton and, I mean, Galen's and what's the other gentleman's name?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I know what you mean.
But, you know, the study that found that that in the political realm, it's exactly the same thing, that that the regular citizen, the only time that their desires are met is when they align with the wealthy and the corporate. So that, you know, so that this, this what has happened is that normal Americans have you know, lost it completely, and yet are able to be, you know, are able to be courted to a certain extent, you know, by these rough notions, if you will.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I must say, in my experience and other people's, to the extent I've heard about it, normal Americans can fairly readily come to understand and embrace these more subtle, more complicated arguments about freedom, freedom as capacity. It's just a political discussion in America is conducted, at least in public, in slogans. And it's there's not much of it in private. You know, I'm sure if you and I went out into, you know, spent a week and went out into homes in Nebraska and Wyoming and wherever, New Mexico, and just talked to ordinary people, Republicans, selected for their apparent allegiance to right-wing ideas, you know, and with our winning personalities, engage them in a fairly unguarded and open and, you know, extended, lengthy conversation, that they would have no trouble grasping and agreeing with these notions. It's just that, you know, imagine somebody trying to make a distinction like that, an argument like that, on say a presidential debate. I mean, the presidential debates never even got to the point of mentioning climate change,
right?
Even
right.
Once. The idea of discussing the nature of freedom is utopian.
Yeah.
But that's what has to happen.
Yeah. So let me ask you, I'm going to bring a couple of these things together, and this will probably bring us close to the close here, which is the, you mentioned utopian. I mentioned Looking Backward, in which Bellamy sets the premise of a citizen of the 23rd century looking back. If you were standing in the future, 10 or 15, 25 years have passed, and looking back, did some of these things turn around? Did they get worse or better? And if so, if they got better, how did that happen? What are the possibilities of society shifting in the directions we might hope? Just, healthy.
Well, there's this phrase of the great physicist Max Planck that science progresses one funeral at a time, which is both hopeful. I mean, it's discouraging in the short run, but very hopeful in the long run. That is, you know, this generation. It's very polarized, unfortunately. There's a lot of bitterness, particularly among Republican voters. And I just don't know that many of them are going to change their minds. But so for the next, you know, 10, 20, 30 years, I'm not sure how much progress and enlightenment to look for, but it does seem like their children, no less than other you know, young people in the 20 to 40 range are just a lot more open, a lot less clenched against each other. And I do think there's some possibility of a real coming together, a real bridging of the kind of partisan divides that allow this plutocratic party that ran all three branches of government until recently to take a wrecking ball to American government and society. I do think that there's a decent chance that these divisions and rancors won't replicate themselves in the next generations and the ones after that. And I think it will only take one generation of real cooperation and political goodwill and good sense to establish precedents that will be enduring. So I guess I would say, I mean, as people always told me, both frustratingly and helpfully, when I was in one or another in the throes of depression, time heals. I think politically, it may be time that will heal our society.
Yeah. One of the things that a notion that's occurred to me, George, in my head, I call it 60s 2.0, just because that's a catchy little meme. But what I was thinking was that I look and I do see a lot of the values that motivated, as I said before, the best of the 60s in millennials, not as rabid consumers, more open to each other in terms of gender and civil rights and so on, wanting more balance in their lives and so on, all of these sorts of things. But I see them with some advantages. And technology, as we're seeing, even just to focus just on the internet, is a very mixed blessing. But the technology does give them the ability to organize quickly, to spread messages, you're not alone if you're sitting in Wyoming having those feelings. So that's one. Two is that there is a reservoir of older folks who hold those same values, whereas I felt like in the 60s, with the 100 beatniks in New York and 100 in San Francisco, basically the 60s young people were on their own, with the exception of a few. And the third is that in the 60s, everything was still, all the most prominent new ideas and new organizations were dominated by white males for the most part, except for a few black and Latino organizations. And I see that there's, again, just so much more talent to call on nowadays, in that the voices of women, of the disenfranchised, of minorities and so on have much more sway. And so I think those values, I'm saying, have advantages that were lacking 50 years ago. And any last thoughts on that one, and then we'll let it go?
Well, they do. I mean, now, in my generation, I went to an all-boys high school. There was an all-girls high school across the street, taught by the nuns of the order that were teaching the boys. And, you know, they were alien beings. You know, they were, slightly, well, quite strange and a little bit absurd to us, but very desirable at the same time. Whereas I think that sense of strangeness and, you know, just separation, alterity, is completely gone. You know, I think boys nowadays seem to have absolutely no, well, boys may, but college students have not the slightest surprise or awkwardness at having female, you know, teachers, and are not going to be the slightest bit surprised at when they go into law schools or mm-hmm. businesses to have female bosses.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that is race, and you know, that's a mixed kind of thing. But I remember I was in Birmingham, Alabama, a couple of years ago, visiting a friend, and asked him, you know, how things were among the younger people, racially speaking. And he said, well, you know, my father was a terrible racist. And, you know, he would beat up black kids and so on all the time when he was growing up. And I was kind of awkward. You know, I would occasionally have a black kid over to the house, but it was always a little antsy. And my kids, you know, basically don't even notice. They have black friends, they have white friends, they in and out of each other's houses. No tension at all. So, yes, I think there is some progress, and there is some, you know, some hope, more along some dimensions than others, but eventually along all of them.
Okay. One thing I will mention, George, where commercial values and cultural values overlap is in TV commercials. In other mm-hmm. words, there's, you know, billion-dollar corporations behind them, and yet they need to reach individuals. And it seems to me, if I go back 5-10 years, that commercials aimed at young people have had, if there's five people sitting there eating a pizza, they're of every ethnicity.
Mm-hmm.
And even couples, it seems to me, I see more mixed-race couples in commercials than I do, you know, at the beach. You know what I mean? It's like there's something going on there that they know that this is the reality of young people. Okay, let's bring it to a close. Again, the books, George's books include What Are Intellectuals Good For? And Low Dishonest Decades. His website is georgeshialaba.net. That's George, and then Shialaba is Scialabba, georgeshialaba.net. For this conversation and many other interviews and articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or a world that just might work.com. That's terrencemcnally.net. And those are actually both, and the world that just might work is one word, a world that just might work.com. They're the same website. And if you want to receive weekly email announcements telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 9 articles that I choose for their relevancy and to flesh out the conversations, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the podcast on iTunes, Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site or at iTunes, and you can listen anytime, anywhere. They include Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle, and so on. You can also follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. Thanks to Mark Maxwell in production, George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all, you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. Thank you, George Shialaba. Keep up your good work.
Thank you, sir.
Okay.
See you soon.
Yep, we will.